wealth is defined in terms of fish, family, and freedom.
Celebrating the importance of salmon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, working to get more Native youth interested in science and engineering.
Getting kids really interested in science and technology and doing something to change their whole lifestyles, and it's doing a wonderful thing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
As modern development speeds towards some of the last truly subsistence-based economies and tribes in the world, researchers are working to better understand this way of life. Two anthropologists from Kenai Peninsula College have been working on a project just like that for the past 2 years and recently presented what they learned in Soldotna. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
Blessing the Water seeks to keep it healthy and provide a suitable home for the salmon and other wild foods the villages and cultures of the area depend on. I learned this, and much more, at a presentation entitled Salmon Science, Stories and Celebration, given by Kenai Peninsula College anthropology professor Dr. Alan Boris in Soldotna. It's the culmination of more than 2 years of meeting and interviewing people in the native villages of Bristol Bay for a study commissioned by the Environmental Protection Agency. Here's Dr. Boris.
So this study, which is really Voices of the People, is to express how that culture operates today, as still operates today, as a salmon culture. And it focuses on the Nushigak and the Kwijak rivers.
He teamed with Dr. Catherine Knott of KPC's Ketchumak Bay campus in Homer and asked just a few basic open-ended questions to gain a better understanding of how tribes there value salmon and other natural resources around them. They interviewed 53 people from seven different villages. Working through a Yupik interpreter, a village elder is asked during one interview what would happen if the salmon didn't come back.
That's our main food, you say we'll starve.
He said we'd starve. When we asked this question, we got some variation of that response. People did not say, well, we'd move away. Well, we'd eat something different. Well, we'd change. Moving away, eating something different was not an option. The depth of the reliance and the importance of salmon in their lives is reflected well, I think, in that response to that question.
Dr. Boris has been studying native culture in the Cook Inlet Basin for nearly 40 years. He says people in the villages where a traditional subsistence lifestyle has managed to remain the primary way of life simply don't view salmon and other food sources or the systems that support them as a commercial commodity.
People raise to the sacred that which is most important in their lives. Salmon and clean water are that thing.
This was just the first of three presentations at KPC on the cultural importance of salmon and wild food to the natives of Bristol Bay. At the next presentation on November 7th, local fishermen and educators will gather to share stories, poems, and songs celebrating salmon. And at the final meeting later in November, scientists will sit in on a panel discussion on king salmon in Cook Inlet. From Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Some changes are on hand this year for applying for big game hunting permits. The application period opened yesterday and will close December 17th. That's 2 weeks earlier than last year. One big change this year is that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game will only accept applications online. A telephone helpline will be available for hunters who don't have internet access. Fish and Game says about 95% of hunters apply online. On average, 15,000 to 17,000 people apply for the permits, and each applicant puts in for an average of 5 hunts. Drawing hunts require an application fee and are awarded by lottery. The three-day American Indian Science and Engineering Society, or ACES, convention drew about 2,000 people to Anchorage this week. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Geological engineer Dr. Dorothy Pender of Fairbanks is co-chair of the local coordinating committee. She says the event brings together Native Americans in all science, technology, engineering, and math fields, from forestry, medicine, and research to mathematics and computer science. Pender says the conference includes sessions for students, educators, and professionals on topics such as wind turbine farms, frozen ground engineering, jobs, grants for scientific research, and more.
There's some fun presentations like building an egg vehicle, how you would transport an egg from one place to another without breaking it. There's a session on Alaska Native games and what the history and purpose were for those. So some of it is serious science and some of it is cultural stuff to welcome people to Alaska and give them a flavor of what Alaska is about.
ACES board member James May of the United Catawba Band of Cherokee of Oklahoma is founder of the California State University Monterey campus. He says the ACES convention can change lives.
This is changing things around because getting kids really interested in science and technology and doing something to change their whole lifestyles, and it's doing a wonderful thing.
Some Alaska Natives have embraced careers in science and technology. This year, ACES gave three of its four annual professional awards to Alaska Natives. One went to Jeff Kneviak, Point Hope Inupiat, and President and CEO of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation Energy Services. ACES says he skillfully balances oil development and environmental concerns of his own culture, which depends on whaling. Linda Benson Kusumoto, a Simpson from Metlakatla, was recognized for her work as a business portfolio manager in space and naval warfare systems at the Navy's Pacific Center, where she oversees a $60 million budget and 32 Department of Defense information systems. And Christopher Scott Nordahl, an Aleut who works as a senior principal engineer for Raytheon Integrated Defense Systems, was honored for putting his PhD in ceramic science to work in nanotechnology research and development. The American Indian Science and Engineering Society Convention continues in Anchorage through Saturday. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Police are again appealing to the public for help investigating a fatal shooting in downtown Anchorage at a nightclub. Police are seeking two specific witnesses in the shooting outside Platinum Jack's last Sunday, in which 27-year-old Sed Bezhiroff was killed. The club was hosting its annual Halloween party at the time. Police spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says detectives are trying to identify two people who attended the party. One person was wearing an Iron Man costume. The other was dressed as the Incredible Hulk. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the mystery and science of breathing.
It certainly does have the aura of science fiction, sort of the old movie depictions of the brains kept alive in the jar of saline.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're curious about the rich marine and terrestrial life of the North Pacific and are looking for an educational adventure, then come to the Sitka Whale Fest on November 1st through the 4th. Hear from prominent scientists, enjoy a 5 and 10K run, and a variety of fun community events and whale-watching cruises. Early registration and discount information at sitkawhalefest.org. Whale Fest is a program of the Sitka Sound Science Center. This message sponsored by the Sitka Whale Fest.
The jury started deliberations today in the case of John Marvin Jr. that's now underway in Juneau. The defense rested its case and closing arguments were held yesterday, the 10th day of a trial in which prosecutors allege that Marvin killed two Hoonah police officers. Member station KTOO's Matt Miller has the story from Juneau.
Marvin told Superior Court Judge David George that he did not want to testify.
I will remain silent.
All right.
Jurors were provided instructions that would allow them to return a verdict for first-degree murder for each of the two officers killed. If they could not be unanimous on the intent to kill, then they were instructed to consider a verdict for second-degree murder or knowingly engaging in conduct that could cause serious injury or death, or a verdict for a lesser charge of manslaughter that could include reckless conduct. Marvin is accused of shooting Sergeant Anthony Wallace and Officer Matthew Tokaoka, who was off duty, on the evening of August 28, 2010. Both men chatted with family on Front Street in Hoonah when they were shot, Wallace in the back and thigh, and then Tokaoka in the chest when he went to his colleague's aid. Neither man apparently knew that they were being targeted. Wallace's mother, as well as Tokaoka's wife Haley and their two children, all witnessed the shooting of Wallace. Wallace's mother, Debbie Green, also witnessed the shooting of Matthew Tokaoka. During closing arguments yesterday, District Attorney Dave Brower once again played the police radio traffic of that night. Brower also showed again to the jury the Browning BAR 7mm rifle believed used in the shooting, the officer's stained clothing with bullet holes, and the bullet fragments recovered during autopsies of both officers.
He harbored a resentment. And he harbored a resentment against Officer Tokaoka and Officer Wallace. So what happened on August 28, 2010, when these two officers were shot down in cold blood? What happened? What caused that? We don't know. Do we know who did it? We do know who did it. The evidence shows that John Marvin is murdered Officer Tokaoka, and murdered Officer Anthony Wallace in cold blood.
During the trial, the theme that emerged from the prosecution was that the 2010 shooting may have been retaliation for an August 2009 arrest, while the defense believes Hoonah officers had already assumed that Marvin was the shooter in August 2010 because of that 2009 incident. Marvin allegedly got into a scuffle with both officers who were responding to a trespass complaint. They used a taser in an attempt to subdue him. The problem, according to public defender Eric Headland, is that the prosecution's case in the shooting is all circumstantial.
Nobody doubts, nobody questions, nor is an issue before any of you, that there are two people who are dead who should not be dead. The question before you is who did it? How they do it, why they do it. The state says this incident in 2009, that's proof. That's proof that Mr. Marvin had a bone to pick with these particular officers.
Headland says no one actually saw Marvin use the rifle to shoot the officers. His house was not adequately monitored immediately following the shooting, and the dying officers did not explicitly say that Marvin did it. Headland also considers the bullet tracking back to Marvin's house as woefully imprecise. 10 men and 2 women will return to the Diamond Courthouse to start deliberations. It's always unknown how long a jury takes to deliberate, but they will have to weigh nearly 200 pieces of evidence and the testimony of nearly 3 dozen witnesses in the case. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
As the campaign season comes to a close, there are few questions remaining about where Fairbanks area candidates stand on the big issues. Everyone wants to lower the cost of energy, and Republicans and Democrats differ sharply on oil tax reform. A Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce forum this week saw a rehash of the familiar topics, but also provided some new insight. KUAC's Dan Bross reports on candidates running for State House Districts 1, 4, and 5.
Candidates largely stuck to well-worn scripts, but also unleashed a little attitude at the Fairbanks Chamber Forum. Incumbent Democrat Scott Kawasaki was critical of his House District 4 opponent, Fairbanks real estate agent and Republican David Prus, indicating Prus is more about big business than regular people.
We've actually had 9 forums, and my opponent hasn't shown up but to 5 of them. I think that says a lot about a person's character and integrity. I think this campaign is about a lot of things, but the one thing it's not about, and the one thing it should be about more, is the character of the person and the qualities that we bring to the table. There's a lot of money in this election. I'm getting outspent 2 or 3 to 1. A lot of outside money is coming in the next week. And I hope that people bear in mind that where that money is coming from.
David Pruse, who has support from business and industry groups, said unlike Kawasaki, he takes their interests seriously. Directing his comments to Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce leaders Lorna Shaw and Lisa Herbert, Pruse said Kawasaki has slighted chamber priorities.
Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce had 7 goals that they wanted to achieve, and one of them was tax reform for the oil industry. It was a very good one. 250 people met down here, 200 people wrote letters. My opponent here classified it as a pep rally. Lorna, Lisa, I'm so proud of the letter that you wrote chastising Representative Kawasaki. This was not a pep rally.
The other Fairbanks area state house candidates also got into it a bit during the forum. In the North Pole District 1 race, political newcomer Janice Golub questioned the value of the experience of her opponent, longtime former North Pole Mayor Doug Isaacson.
Some of your experience, though, it might be superior in some ways, but in other ways, I think it's not so good. You've had bankruptcies. You've had a recall election. I haven't had to go through that. And there's been ethics complaints as well. So I feel that, there's certain levels of experience that might not be someplace that I want to go.
Golub's career is the military, and she said in many ways that experience parallels government service. North Pole politics can be contentious, and Isaacson absorbed some bumps during his tenure, but he said in the end he knows how to get results.
The nice thing about being a mayor is nonpartisan, and you just have to fight for your community. And we built a great little community out in North Pole, and I didn't do it by slinging mud, but by incorporating people into the process of community.
Isaacson stressed his goal of negotiating a break on state royalty oil as an immediate way to lower interior energy prices. Golub pointed to the need to look beyond oil and develop renewable sources like hydropower. No candidates shied away from spending to better Alaska, even for mega projects like Susitna Dam, North Slope Gas Line, or Roads to Resources. District 5 Republican Pete Higgins plugged loosening the purse strings to advance the state.
We haven't built any infrastructure in years, and it's time we need to start doing that. We need to start putting our money for the future. And so I'm all for spending the money. It's our money, so let's do it. Let's, we keep saying we're saving it for a rainy day. The rainy day is here.
Higgins was also aggressive about the need to cut oil taxes, saying the industry's state and federal payout should not equate to double its profits. Higgins' House District 5 opponent, Democrat Dave Watts, disagreed, saying the industry is healthy and moving ahead on new exploration, and extra state oil tax revenue should be used to help people.
Education programs, job training programs, the University of Alaska, those are all essential resource development. We need to have people capable of functioning efficiently in the future. And then after we have that, we need to develop our natural resources.
Watts said we need to consider that oil sitting in the ground is appreciating in value, but cautioned there's also a time to pressure industry, like in the case of previously stalled Point Thompson development on the North Slope. The State House races are among those to be decided by voters in Tuesday's general election. For KUAC News in Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Layla Carey. This week on AK, breathe. Election stormy weather, the impending winter darkness, we all need to take a deep breath this time of year. Luckily, our bodies can't forget to breathe, but we've all forgotten when and how breathing originated. Scientists at the University of Alaska Fairbanks may have discovered the origins of the process. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, they've found an answer in a primitive fish that still swims Alaska's rivers.
The constant drone of a large cooler hums in the corner of Michael Harris's lab at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Harris is a respiratory neurobiologist. He's keeping tiny juvenile lamprey in that cooler, and he's convinced they hold the secret to the evolution of air breathing in humans.
At rest, right now standing here, we actually breathe in order to get rid of carbon dioxide that we produce through metabolism. And if we do that effectively, we can't help but get all the oxygen we need.
Harris says our bodies know when and how to expel carbon dioxide because of sensors in our brains. But he doesn't know when humans developed those sensors. That's what the lamprey are for. They're an extremely primitive fish. They don't breathe air, but they do use gills to take in oxygen. Harris decided to look at lamprey brains up close to find out if they were also sensitive to carbon dioxide.
It certainly does have the aura of science fiction, sort of the old movie depictions of the brains kept alive in the jar of saline. That is actually what we do, and it does actually work.
With the help of lab technician Megan Hoffman, Harris exposed nerves in the lamprey brains to different concentrations of the gas. The result was nerve activity that is typically associated with breathing. Harris believes it's the kind of activity that eventually led air-breathing animals to cough in response to bad air, or in this case, lots of carbon dioxide.
When we induced a cough for the first time with carbon dioxide, I think we both laughed hysterically.
You laughed too, Megan?
Yeah, I did.
What
it was
made
pretty.
You laugh?
It was just exciting to see it work. And then especially when we stimulated it with CO2 and it coughed more, that was particularly exciting.
Now, part of the reason Harris and Hoffman laugh is because what they consider a lamprey cough really does look funny. I'll get to that in a minute. After testing brains, Harris tried the same experiment with a live lamprey. In the lab, there's a small aquarium with about 2 inches of water in the bottom. A long, skinny pink and brown lamprey rests in a glass tube under the water. A microscope projects a video as Harris exposes the lamprey to carbon dioxide.
Oh, he does look like he coughed.
He does look like he coughs, absolutely.
Can you do that one more time?
The lamprey undulates from front to back as if it has the hiccups, and the water moves in a wave out of the tube. These fish spend their first 5 years in burrows they dig into the bottom of riverbeds throughout interior Alaska.
What we think then is that the buildup of CO2 in the water in an occluded tunnel stimulates a response in the animals to cough. And when they cough, they expel water from their pharynx back out the front of their body, which would make a water current in the tunnel that would blow the mud out of the occlusion.
Carbon dioxide builds up in those burrows as the lamprey sit and filter feed. Harris collaborates with neuroscientist Barbara Taylor. She says the simplicity of this experiment is what makes their findings so exciting.
We strive for that.
We love that.
When it's elegantly simple, that's when you can think you're really onto something.
Both Taylor and Harris are interested in finding out more about how different pathologies, like central sleep apnea, sudden infant death syndrome, and Rett syndrome, developed as animals evolve to breathe air.
So if we can understand that how lamprey control cough is generated by the same types of neurons that are the neurons that are so important to human health that when they fail, breathing fails, we can understand what are critical elements and what are peripheral elements or elements that are secondary to the critical system.
Harris is halfway through experiments with live lamprey. He presented his research at the annual Society for Neuroscience in New Orleans earlier this month. He says he was so excited about the response that he wrote up a manuscript for publication on his flight back home. He hopes to have his results published within the next few months. For AK, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading out to the Pribilof Islands and the community of St. George on a small island in the Bering Sea between Alaska and Russia.
My name is Patrick Plutnikoff, and I'm the mayor for the city of St. George, Pribilof Islands in the Bering Sea. It is a unique island in that fur seals by the thousands breed here every summer, and by the millions, seabirds, about 100 species, nest and breed on our cliffs. And we have the opportunity to observe whales on their annual migration north. Our people came originally from the Aleutian Islands and were brought here first by the Russians to harvest fur seals. In 1867, when Alaska was sold to the United States, the United States government maintained fur sealing operations on both St. George and St. Paul until 1983. Our government, along with the state of Alaska, promised that they would help St. George and St. Paul Islands transition into an economy of fisheries. Since 1983, we're still working on that because that particular promise has yet to be fulfilled. It is extremely difficult at St. George at this point. Like many communities in the state of Alaska, we are seeing a significant out-migration of our people. We've seen over the last 3 years a drop from approximately 120 people to 80. You know, it's been pointed out since 1983 that St. George lies in the midst of the greatest fishery in the world, so to speak, certainly in the Bering Sea. What's ironic is that this fishery produces almost $2 billion annually, and not one cent sticks to St. George.
Pat Pletnikoff is the mayor of St. George. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Schwing, Kristen Spack, and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Matt Miller in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Layla Carey was our AK guest host this week. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.